Okay, so I guess we can start. And just to start off, just to give a little bit of introduction before we get into the actual suttas. As I said before, this is going to be it's quite a long retreat. There's many, many sessions. There's 8 days, 4 sessions a day. That's 32 hours of Dhamma talks. It's a lot, right? Oh. So because of that, I have expanded the suttas a little bit from last year when I was here. And the main focus on the retreat is going to be the gradual training, my favorite aspect of the suttas, which gives you a very clear instruction how the practice works, all the way from the beginning of the path all the way to the end. So it's a very practical teaching, something that you can apply in your own life without any problem whatsoever. But I also want to expand it a little bit and look at some of the framework for the suttas, some of the things that the Buddha talked about regarding the suttas, how to look at them, what is the important aspect of his teachings, and these kind of things. So to give you a bit of background, basically, because we have so many hours, we have time to do that as well, which is great, right? We have kind of have a chance to look at things in a bit more detail, a bit more bones, meat on the bones, so to speak. To do that, I'm going to have a look this morning at the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, which I'm sure most of you will be familiar with. It is the Sutta of the Buddha's passing away, and it talks about the last journey of the Buddha, when the Buddha walks all the way from Rajagaha, you know, Rajagaha and Magadha, and he walks all the way to Kushinara, where he eventually passes away. Have many of you here been to India? Yeah, okay, great, that's good. So you have some idea what I'm talking about when I talk about these names. It's great to have been there. You get, this is where the Buddha was, right? And you have a feeling for these things. So now he's starting out in Rajagaha. This is the last journey of the Buddha as he walks from the capital of the ancient Magadhan country, which later on becomes the great empire of Ashoka, and all the way up to Kushinara. And this sutta is very interesting for many reasons. One of the reasons why it is interesting is that it is not so much a sutta in the ordinary sense. Usually a sutta is a discourse by the Buddha. The Buddha explains a particular topic in a certain amount of detail or whatever. But the Mahaparinibbana Sutta is not that kind of discourse. It is it's more like a narrative. It's a story. It's a story of how the Buddha's last journey takes place and how eventually he passes away. So it's not an ordinary discourse at all. And this makes it slightly different from the ordinary teachings that we have. So what the Mahaparinibbana Sutta really is about, it's about the Buddha then doing this walk, and as he does that, because he knows that he's coming to his final days, he knows that he's about to pass away, right? So what he does in the sutta is to lay down the last instructions to his Buddhist disciples, to the Sangha, on what to do when he passes away. So he lays down things like, what are the important teachings, right? What are the things that you should really memorize? What are the things you should pass on to future generations to make sure the Dhamma is available in the world for a long time into the future, right? To make sure that the Dhamma is available in KL in 2,500 years' time, right? Or in Perth, or in Singapore, or wherever it is. This is what he's kind of thinking in this particular sutta. So that is very important, and it gives us a lot of insight in what the Buddha himself considered the core aspects of his teachings. This is very interesting, right? People are always arguing, what are the real teachings of the Buddha? Did he teach the Mahayana Suttas? Did he teach the Abhidhamma? And all of these kind of things. And here, basically, the Buddha gives expression to these things. He gives us a very clear outlook on what is important in these teachings. So for this reason, it is actually very, very exciting here. And then, of course, it is not just that, but it's also laying down the rules, if you like, for the Sangha. What kind of conduct, what kind of behavior is going to work in the long run to also make sure that the sasana, the Buddhist dispensation, is established for a long time into the future. So here he kind of lays down all these fundamental things which then ensure that Buddhism is going to be able to survive for a long time. And all of this, of course, is very very interesting, and it creates a beautiful framework to understand all the other suttas on that basis. So this is why I want to talk about this sutta. I've been talking a lot about the Mahaparinibbana Sutta recently. I've been teaching it to the monks at Bodhinyana Monastery as well. So I'm really having a lot of fun with this sutta. So we're going to have a bit more look at that. So some of this is really just extracts that I've taken here. To read the whole sutta and do it in detail will probably take all the 32 sessions of this entire retreat. That's how much information is in this particular sutta. So we're just going to pull out some of the most important stuff for this particular context. Okay, so this is how it starts. This is page number 2 in the booklet, The Great Passing Away, DN 16. Soon after Vasakara had gone, the Lord said, Ananda, go to whatever monks there are around about Rajagaha and summon them to the assembly hall. Very good, Lord, said Ananda, and he did so. So just to give you some idea what is happening here, because this Vasakara is suddenly being talked about without any context. Vasakara was the chief minister of Magadha at that time. He was one of the main attendants to King Ajatasattu, who was the king of the Magadhan Empire, right? And at the opening of the sutta, the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, King Ajatasattu says to Vasakara, I want to annihilate the Vajjayan Republic. The Vajjayan Republic is to the north of the river Ganges, those of you who may remember that. The south you have Magadha, Rajagaha and Patna, and to the north you have the Vajjayans, the capital being Vesali. And you can still go to Vesali in the present day and see some of the remnants there as well. And a Ashokan pillar is there if you stoop and that sort of thing here. So he says to his chief minister, I want to annihilate these Vajjayans. I want to destroy them, to make them into nothing, basically. Really, I want to take over their country, is of course basically what it means. Right, and then he says to Vasakara, go to the Buddha to find out what the Buddha has to say about this, right? It's kind of strange, right? Because then he says, well, the Buddha's never lies, so whatever information the Buddha gives you is going to come in very handy. Maybe we can use some of the information the Buddha gives us to help us destroy these Vajjayans. So essentially he's saying to Vasakara, let's see if the Buddha can help us in our warfare against this country to the north. It's kind of strange, right? And you wonder what these kings were thinking. According to the earlier suttas in the Sammanyapala Sutta, he had faith in the Buddha, and he came and he had regretting, he killing his father, and all these kind of things in the Sammanyapala Sutta. And now suddenly he wants to ask the Buddha for advice on how to conduct warfare, which is kind of almost going in the exact opposite direction. So it's kind of weird. And then, of course, then the Buddha gives advice to Vasakara. He says to Vasakara that before I taught these 7 ways of living, the 7 ways of conducting the affairs to the Vajjayans, and he says that if the Vajjayans practice in this way, they will be very strong as a consequence. And then he teaches these 7 ways to Vasakara. And I think the purpose of the Buddha is probably to put the Vasakara off a little bit. Said, don't invade the Vajjayans. They are doing very well. They are very strong as they are, right? There's no need to actually invade them. Moreover, these particular aspects create a strong republic. You too should take on these particular practices in Magadha and practice accordingly in the Magadhan Republic as well. But of course, Vasakara is the chief minister, and his job is not to take the Dhamma on board. His job is to kind of follow what the king says. So he thinks, oh, the Buddha has said this, okay, how can we use this information from the Buddha to attack the Vajjayans? Right? So the Buddha is trying to kind of calm them down, but he straight away takes it the wrong way. And what he says, well, if the Vajjayans are so strong, we have to use propaganda against them. We have to divide them internally, right? This is always how you weaken people. You divide them internally, one against the other. And that is the only way we're going to be able to beat these Vajjayans. So this is the background here. It's a very interesting story because one of the things that you see when you read the suttas, you see the beginning of the expansion of the Magadhan Empire. King Ajatasattu's father was King Bimbisara, who you may probably have heard about, very famous king at that time. And he was a stream enter who had full faith in the Buddha and all these kind of things. And King Bimbisara, it seems, was the first one who started the expansion of the Magadhan Empire. He invaded what is called the Anga country, which lies to the east of Magadha. The capital city was known as Champa. And in the suttas, in the Vinaya, usually this kingdom is now called Anga Magadha. In other words, it's a combination of two countries, Anga and Magadha being one thing. And this seems to be the beginning of the expansion of this empire. And then when you read the suttas, you come to the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, like here, you can see the continuation of that expansion. Now, King Ajatasattu wants to go to the north of the river Ganges to conquer the Vajjayans, right? Earlier on in the suttas, you find also King Ajatasattu, he is kind of vying with King Pasenadi of Kosala, fighting over Varanasi, Benares. Benares already existed in those days. And eventually King Ajatasattu is the one who wins and takes over Benares, right? You can see the expansion going on here and how this is gradually happening over a long period of time. And of course, what is very interesting, if you move forward in history about 100 years after the time of the Buddha, then the Magadhan Empire has been established. And this is known from historical sources. Historical sources, sort of like some of the Greek ambassadors that were in India. Other sources are, of course, the Ashokan pillars. It's a little bit later, about 150 years after the Buddha. And then we know from those historical sources that the Magadhan Empire was already very large. And it covered essentially all the north of India at that particular time. Right, I don't know if you know your history, you will know that Alexander the Great, he was the king of Macedonia, which is part of the ancient Greece, and he invaded eastwards, going over what is now Turkey, across Iran, right, and then into the north of India. And then when he came to the river Indus, the Indus River, this was about year 325 BC, so maybe 70, 80 years after the Buddha passed away. When he got there, the army of the great Alexander the Great, they heard that way over in the east, in the Ganges Valley, there's a capital city called Pataliputra, and there's a King Nanda there. And King Nanda, he is so incredibly powerful. He has thousands of elephants and thousands of troops and all this stuff. And then they rebelled against Alexander the Great. We're not going to go any further because this king, he's just too powerful. And that is one of the reasons why Alexander the Great stopped at the river Indus River, right? Because it was too scary to meet this King Nanda sitting over in Pataliputra somewhere. So this is only a few decades after the Buddha passed away. And already it is known, right, in the larger sphere that this kingdom is very, very powerful, ruled by King Nanda in Pataliputra. So you can see how the suttas match with the historical records. You can see how the expansion of the Magadhan Empire is happening in the suttas and the Vinaya, and how that matches with the historical record of Magadha becoming very, very great after the a few decades after the Buddha has passed away here. This is always very nice. I like these kind of things because it's important that the suttas should match history. If the suttas match history, it gives you confidence that these are well-preserved documents that actually have kept intact information that goes back to that time. And it makes you get a feeling that not if the historical things have been preserved properly. Remember, historical things are marginal. What is really important for the monastics was always the suttas. But if they have even preserved the historical things, then surely the suttas have been preserved far more efficiently and far better than these particular historical points. So it gives you a very strong feeling that this is the real deal. These are the actual word of the Buddha that we're talking about in this Four Nikayas. And it's not just that historical development, there are other historical developments as well, such as the city of Pataliputra, which becomes the capital of the Magadhan Empire. In the suttas, this city doesn't really exist at all. It is a tiny little village on the last trip of the Buddha. Before the last trip of the Buddha, it's not even mentioned anywhere in the suttas. It's almost as if it doesn't exist. It comes into existence at the very end of the Buddha's life. And then it's called Patali Gama. It's a tiny village. And of course, at the time of Ashoka, or even before Ashoka, Ashoka's grandfather, Chandragupta, who was the first emperor of the Mauryan dynasty in India, about 100 years after the Buddha, at that time, the Greek ambassador, Megasthenes, he writes about Pataliputra and says, it's this magnificent city, enormous, 3 by 2 kilometers long, with large kind of wooden walls and big towers and all of these kind of things. So things have changed enormously, and you can see how it fits in to the historical pattern. Things are developing in the right, in a certain way. So I don't know. I find these historical, little historical things very important. It's of course great to have faith that the Buddha, Buddha's teachings. But sometimes you get even more faith when you see that these are real historical events in this way. Only very useful. Anyway, so now we are. It's a bit of a digression there. I'm not sure if I was supposed to talk about all of that, but anyway, that's what happens sometimes. So now he has just left Vasakara. I left all that out because it wasn't really so relevant to what I wanted to talk about. But anyway, and now, of course, the Buddha wants to give a similar discourse to the monks that he has just given to Vasakara. So Ananda brings all the monks together, and then he came to the Lord, saluted him. Salute means to bow down to him. Not sure if salute is a very good word, but anyway, stood to one side and said, Lord, the order of monks is assembled. Now is the time for the Lord to do as he sees fit. Then the Lord rose from his seat, went to the assembly hall, sat down on the prepared seat and said, Monks, I will teach you 7 things that are conducive to welfare. Listen, pay careful attention, and I will speak. Yes, Lord, said the monks, and the Lord said this. So you can see it is obviously this is an important teaching that the Buddha is about to give. He assembles all the monks, right? And he says, listen, pay careful attention. It's the kind of thing that you see sometimes in the suttas. When the Buddha talks on his own initiative, nobody's actually asking him. He's given instructions on his own initiative in this particular case. So it's obviously going to be important. And these things that are coming now, these 7 things that he's going to talk about, these are the things that the Buddha lays down as being crucial for the future maintenance of the Buddha's teachings. Right? So important for us today as well, because it's about us too, how we can ensure the future survival of the Buddha's teachings. We have to practice these same 7 factors as the Buddha laid down here. So quite exciting, right? So now, this is what the BGF should be doing in the future, right? So now, I suppose the last day I'm here, I'm supposed to talk about the harmony within the kind of Buddhist groups. That is always a problem. Every Buddhist group in the world, there's always, any group, anywhere, there's always going to be a little bit of kind of friction and problem. That's just the nature of being a human being, I think. Yeah. So it's always good to be reminded of these things that can kind of create that harmony, sense of well-being, people moving together forward rather than kind of being held back by conflict and this kind of thing. Yeah. So this is actually quite interesting. So this is what he said. As long as the monks hold regular and frequent assemblies, they may be expected to prosper and not decline. I'll read through the whole list and I'll go back to the beginning again. As long as they meet in harmony, break up in harmony, and carry on their business in harmony, they may be expected to prosper and not decline. As long as they do not authorize what has not been authorized already, and do not abolish what has been authorized, but proceed according to what has been authorized by the rules of training, so long they can be expected to prosper and not decline. As long as they honor, respect, revere, and salute, bow down to the elders of long standing, who are long ordained, the fathers, and we should probably say also the mothers, and leaders of the order, so long they can be expected to prosper and not decline. As long as they do not fall prey to desires which arise in them and lead to rebirth, so long they can be expected to prosper and not decline. As long as they are devoted to forest lodgings, they can be expected to prosper and not decline. As long as they preserve their personal mindfulness so that in future the good among the companions will come to them, and those who have already come will feel at ease with them. They can be expected to prosper and not decline. As long as the monks hold to these seven things and are seen to do so, they may be expected to prosper and not decline. So, first of all, the emphasis here is on the Sangha, right? The Sangha, you can see all of these things really refer to the Sangha. And so it shows you that the core of Buddhism in many ways is that the Sangha works well. When the Sangha works reasonably well, then Buddhism tends to prosper as a consequence. But of course, it's not just the Sangha. These are also qualities that can be used for organizations like any Buddhist organization anywhere in the world, really. So they are important for everyone in many ways. But the Sangha is certainly core. And this is one of the things that you get out of this straight away. So the first thing here is this idea of holding regular and frequent assemblies. Right? And I think this is one of the reasons why in the Sangha it is laid down that we have to meet at the very least once a fortnight on the Uposatha day, the full moon and the new moon. So at least every fortnight you have to meet together as a Sangha, as a group. And you can imagine if you hold frequent assemblies, what that does, it allows you to iron out any problems, right? When it's like a family, when you talk together and you converse together, you kind of sort out problems that may arise on the way here. And then hopefully in the long run you have a sense of harmony. And the Sangha is a bit like a family, right? You live very close together. Not quite like a family, because you don't have quite as many attachments, hopefully, but you know, it is a little bit of a similar thing because you're living together in a way here. So you iron out the problems. And when you iron out the problems, and if you do that in a good way, you move forward with a sense of unity of purpose. And that unity of purpose is always, of course, to allow the Dhamma to prosper in the world, to practice in your own way, to make sure that you are, you are going in the right direction as well as the Sangha as a whole. So I think this idea of frequent assemblies and meeting frequently is very important. So this is the first thing to keep in mind, both for the Sangha and also for lay Buddhist organizations as well. And the second one here is very closely related to that, is the idea of meeting in harmony. You come together in harmony, you produce, you do the business in harmony, and then you leave in harmony afterwards. What is interesting about this is that this word harmony is sammagga or sammaggi in Pali. And this has two meanings in the Pali language. One, the first meaning and the most basic meaning is unity. Right, that everybody actually comes together. So, and this is why when we have meetings in the Sangha, every meeting we have, everybody has to be present. You're not allowed not to be there. And if one monk is not present, we cannot actually have the meeting. There is one way out of that, and that is the monk is allowed to send his, it's called a chanda in Pali, it means his consent. So he consents to the community doing any kind of business they need to do in his absence. But at the very least, he has to send his consent, right? So everybody has to be present. You might perhaps think that, so this is the first thing. Of course, if everybody is present, the second thing that comes from that is that not only do everybody have to be present, but they have to agree. Everybody has to agree on the business that is being done. If one person is against a particular point, you cannot actually go ahead according to the rules of the Sangha. So if you want to be ordained, right, if you're young and you think, oh yeah, I want to be ordained in the Sangha, you have to be nice to all the monks. Because if you're not nice to one, he's going to say no when you want to be ordained. This is one of the problems of... It's not that bad, actually. We tend to be quite forgiving and quite kind to people. So if you usually, unless you're a real scallywag, you won't have any problems becoming ordained in most monasteries. But the idea is that everybody has to agree. And there's something very beautiful about that. You may think that it leads to gridlock and impossible if everybody has to agree, because usually it's very hard to find any place anywhere where everybody agrees, but it does not lead to gridlock if it is done in a wise way. And the wise way to do these things is that if somebody disagrees, you try to find out why. Why do they disagree, right? What is your reason? Maybe they have a good point. So you listen to their point of view, and you try to accommodate that person as well. And usually, if everybody is mature and everybody is reasonable and there's not too many egos involved, egos are always a problem, right? They tend to kind of get in the way. So if you kind of let go of your ego a little bit, and then what happens then is that you accommodate pretty much everyone. And then when everybody is accommodated and everybody agrees, then, of course, you have a great sense of harmony in the community because nobody feels left out. This is one of the problems with the modern ideas of democracy, is that modern ideas of democracy is often that there's a minority that often feels left out, right? Okay, then. But in the Sangha, it isn't like that. The idea is unanimity. The idea is absolute majority. Everybody has to agree here. And it has, when you do that in the right way, it creates a very powerful sense of harmony. When everybody moves along together and everybody kind of feels they're part of the group, everybody has a say in a sense. I think this is a very good principle to use, not just in the Sangha, but also in any organization, is the idea that not everybody has to agree, but always to listen to the minority position. Try to accommodate people, right? And when you accommodate minority positions as well, you find a middle way where everybody is reasonably happy, then it's easier to move forward in harmony. People don't get upset so much. People don't feel left out. People don't feel trampled upon by others. And this can have a very beneficial effect. So this is the idea of working in harmony in the Sangha. And it works remarkably well. This is a system that we use to a large extent at Bodhinyana Monastery in Perth. And it tends to work. And if somebody is very intransigent and they don't want to kind of go on board, then often what we do, we say to them, well, this is what the majority wants. Would you be so, are you willing, just to, out of respect for the majority, to come along anyway? And usually, people are mature enough to actually say, yes, no problem. I will actually move along with everyone else. So that is that second principle there, and something that I have found very, very useful in my monastic life. And then we have the idea that you do not authorize, right, what has not been authorized, or abolish what has been authorized, but proceed according to what has already been laid down. And this is a very important principle as well, and it has very profound effects on how we understand the Buddha's teachings and how we understand the monastic discipline, the monastic rules. Because what the Buddha is saying here is that the things that he has laid down, in other words, the rules, the vinaya, the discipline, but also the suttas, that is the foundation stone for Buddhism. So you don't abolish any of that. You don't chuck it out. And you don't kind of add new stuff and say, yeah, the Buddha said this, right? And you kind of put in a kind of a false sutta there, which the Buddha says, and now this is authorized. This has happened in the history of Buddhism, right? The Buddha said this. Well, actually, he didn't say that, but somebody kind of, somehow it was kind of added to these early suttas. So it becomes a very important principle for deciding what are the core teachings. What are those things that are the final standard by which we judge everything else? Those things that actually, are pretty much indisputable. Because we all have to agree that the Buddha was awakened. If the Buddha wasn't awakened, kind of everything collapses like a house of cards. But everybody else is a bit more uncertain. So it's important to have that gold standard there. So a lot of the things, as monastics, for example, the way we use this kind of rules here, the monastic vinaya is a very complex document, the code of discipline for the monks and for the nuns, and it is very layered. You have many different kind of, it was put down over a long, long period of time. So what we do with those rules, we look at those rules that the Buddha laid down, that is the minimum standard that you have to keep. And then we look at the explanations of those rules found in the commentary, found in other parts of the vinaya, and we follow those. If they are good explanations that make good sense in our contemporary society, we tend to follow those things. But sometimes the explanation may be completely out of whack with contemporary society, in which case occasionally we say, well, it wasn't laid down by the Buddha, it wasn't really authorized by him, so in that case we don't actually follow that kind of rules, if you like, laid down by other people later on. So I'll give you an example, just one small little example that you may be aware of. For example, in Thailand, they have this idea that, you know, you have to use a receiving cloth, right? If you are a monk and you're going to receive something from a woman, you have to use a receiving cloth. But that's not actually in the Vinaya. That's actually a Thai tradition. You don't find it anywhere else. So then when you go to Australia or you come to Malaysia or whatever, you have to ask yourself, well, do we really need to follow this particular tradition in this particular circumstance? And if you want to be inclusive, and in Australia we want to be very inclusive, bring in all the various traditions of Buddhism. If you want to be inclusive, sometimes you have to put aside those things that are relevant only for one particular culture. Yeah? This is just one tiny example to give you some idea of how we do these things in practice. And of course, the very easy thing that we will probably see later on as well, that comes out of this, not to authorize anything new, but to keep the old things, is that basically that which was authorized by the Buddha are the four Nikayas, right? The four basic Nikayas in the Pali, the long discourses, middle discourses, connected discourses, and the numerical discourses. That's essentially what is the word of the Buddha, plus a little bit from the Vinaya Pitaka, which is the monks and the monastic code of conduct, if you wish. Okay. So then we have the next one. This is about honoring, respecting, revering, and saluting the elders of long standing who have long ordained the fathers and leaders of the Sangha. And so this is to balance out a little bit the idea of democracy. Sometimes democracy doesn't work if the kind of the youngest monk in the line who was ordained yesterday, if he is very opinionated, right? It can create lots of problems in the Sangha. So you have to have that sense of respect and honor towards the seniors in the community. And this is something, of course, that usually works very well, especially if those senior monks and nuns have a lot of integrity and they have practiced well, then there is a natural respect that tends to arise towards people like that. So this tends to work out very, very well in society. So there is this balance, this tension, if you like, in the Sangha, and probably also perhaps within any lay organization, between respecting natural authority of the elders, and on the other hand, having a sense of democracy where everybody has a say, right? That balance is important. And when you get that balance right, then it tends to work quite nicely. So as a young monk, you tend to think, well, this is my opinion, but if the elders say it this way, okay, I'll just go along out of respect. I may disagree right now, but let me go along out of disrespect. And then maybe in the future, I will find out maybe I was wrong in my opinion. This is the kind of way that is often nice to follow in that kind of situation. You have a chance to speak, but in the end, you go along with the elders. Okay. Then we have that they do not fall prey to the desires which arise in them and lead to rebirth. Actually, I should add one little thing about the previous one. It is not just that you respect them, but you think that they should be listened to. For some reason, the translator has missed that out. But you think that those elders are to be listened to, right? Worthy of being listened to because of their more experience. Okay, as long as you do not fall prey to desires which arise in them and lead to rebirth. So what are these desires that arise in one and lead to rebirth? And to understand that, it's actually quite straightforward, right? You go to the second noble truth. The second noble truth is about the desires that lead to rebirth. The porno bhavika, quite literally means again existence again in the future, and tanna is cravings. The craving which leads to rebirth is what the second noble truth says. And what is that craving that leads to rebirth? It is specifically said there to be kama tanha, the desire for sensual pleasures, right? The sensual objects in the world. Bhavatana, the desire for existence. And vibhavatana, the desire to be annihilated or exterminated, if you like. And of those, the first one is by far the most important one. The desire for sensual things in the world. So this is rebirth leading, right? This is a thing that kind of takes you around the round of samsara, moves you on from one life to the next one. That is probably the most important of all the fetters that tie you down and ensure that you get reborn again and again and again, is this tying down to sensuality in the world. And it's quite a difficult message, right, to take this on board, because for many people, this is the only happiness they have in a sense. The happiness of sensual pleasures, right, going to a nice restaurant, having a nice relationship, and these kind of things. So when you hear this, you think, oh no, this is too much. The Buddha is asking too much. I can't give these things up. I have nothing left, right? My life is miserable and useless and pointless. I have to have some kind of happiness in the world. So it's a very tough message. But of course, it is a misunderstanding to think that giving these things up is a negative thing. The whole point of the Buddhist path is a gradual giving up of certain things and a gradual accumulation of other things. And the things that you accumulate, if you like, is not really an accumulation because you don't really grasp onto it. But what you kind of build up instead, you build up the happiness inside which comes from practicing the Noble Eightfold Path. This is the purpose of this, right? And of course, as you build up that happiness inside, as your meditation improves, that's the theory, it's supposed to improve, right? Some people, oh, my meditation isn't improving, where am I going wrong? So you have to then look inside, why is my meditation improving? And then do something about it. So as that happens, it's natural that your interest in the external things in the world, it tends to die away, because you have a more profound sense of happiness, a more secure sense of happiness, a more reliable sense of happiness coming from inside of you that is actually far superior to the happiness of sensuality from the outsider. And that is the right way of doing it, right? So don't think that you are giving something up and having nothing in return. If you do this in the right way, you are slowly, slowly, slowly giving up one thing and gradually, gradually gaining something else. It's a slow process. And as that process works, you realize that you're actually gaining far more than you are losing here. But remember this, it's one I think it's a very interesting point of the Dhamma, that the one thing that ties you to samsara more than anything else is the sensual desire and the sensual pleasures of the world. Why does it tie you down? Because sensual pleasures are almost always about the future. It's where I want to go. It's the kind of the objects in the world I would like to have, right? What kind of house I want to have? What kind of car I want to have? What kind of relationship I want to have? What kind of holiday I want to go on to? It tends to be about the future. And even when you are kind of enjoying the results of that craving, because you have been working very hard to get there, still there is a residue of craving inside, which still is moving you towards the future. It is very rare that you find contentment in the realm of sensual pleasures. It's always moving towards the future. And because it is moving towards the future, it means in a sense that you are projecting yourself into that future. You're always looking to the future. It means your mind is always somewhere else, right? Moving somewhere else. One of the reasons why it's difficult to become peaceful in meditation practice. So because of that, it's almost as if we are creating that future as we go along. And as you create that future as you go along, this is how rebirth then is reproduced, because of that projection into the future in this way. When all the craving dies away, you become completely still. You're not creating any future anymore. And that is how the end of rebirth can eventually happen. So that is the sensual craving is by far the most important one that the Buddha is talking about here. And this, again, remember, is for monastics. And of course, for monastics, it is really important, because you cannot really live monastic life properly if you have too much of this kind of craving. It's going to be very, very disturbing and make life very difficult for you. It is not just about sensual craving, it is about other kind of worldly cravings as well, right? Craving for position, craving for a place in the hierarchy, craving for power, all of these kind of things, of course, are part of that. You're craving to be famous, craving to be I don't know what it is. All of these things that also kind of creep into monastic life sometimes. This is one of the terrible things about the hierarchies, right? If you look around the Buddhist world, there are so many hierarchies everywhere. You look at the Sangha in Thailand. The Sangha in Thailand was built up in this modern way it works. Was built up by King Mongkut, Rama the Fourth, I think it was, in about the 1850s or something like that. And when he, this is true, that when he built up the Sangha in Thailand, he modeled the Sangha on the Catholic Church. Right? Because in those days, they were getting all these Western ideas into Thailand, right? And of course, the West at that time was kind of, when it came to science, when it came to technology, and it came to military, it was much stronger than you know, a country like Thailand. So for that reason, they thought, oh, wow, the Western ideas, they must be really good, right? Because they have so much whatever else it is. So he then looked to the Catholic Church, and the Catholic Church is one of the most hierarchical organizations in the world. On the top, you have the Pope, right? The Pope is supposed to be in direct connection with God, right? So God tells the Pope, okay, do this, Pope, okay. And then, of course, that is how the Pope then has absolute authority, because he is in connection with the divine, right? That's why he has absolute authority. And then it is structured in this incredible pyramid all the way down to the ordinary Catholic on the bottom. And so you're building up Buddhism, which is supposed to be a democratic teaching where the Sangha works together and everybody has a vote. You turn that into this massive hierarchy instead, which is basically the exact opposite of what the Sangha is supposed to be here. So this is why you get problems. And of course, once you have that hierarchy, people want to get to the top, right? That's the nature of hierarchies. You want to, because when you're on the top, you have more power, you have more access to money, you have more access to influence. You can get things your way. So hierarchies in the world are, I think, inherently lead to corruption, because people want to kind of move up the hierarchy and do something. And that is why I think it's such a bad idea for the Sangha to have a hierarchy here. That's why the Sangha in the early Buddhism didn't even have abbots, because abbots already, you have a little bit of hierarchy, right? So I've been trying to tell Ajahn Brahm, maybe you should give up your abbot position, right? So I can become abbot instead, right? Oh, power. No, I have, but Ajahn Brahm is not really he's not a very kind of dictatorial abbot at all. He's very kind of relaxed about things. But basically the idea of even abbotship is actually basically not really part of the early Buddhist teachings. So all of these things are the danger of these desires, right? And so as a monastic especially, you have to try to avoid getting entangled in those things. If you do, it's going to lead to the downfall of Buddhism. That's what it's basically saying here, right? It will not lead, it will lead away from prosperity and to the decline instead. And this is, again, a very good reason for getting rid of some of the hierarchies in the Buddhist world. And then we have the next one, which is very closely connected to the one about the wrong kinds of desires. And this is, as long as the monks and the nuns, the monastics, are devoted to forest lodgings, they can be expected to prosper and not decline. Right? And I always found this particularly a line very interesting and very kind of powerful, and it shows you why the forest tradition as in the Sangha is so important. It is so important that actually it supports the entire, upholds all of Buddhism, right? If the monks and nuns stop living in the forest, we can expect decline, not prosperity. That is what it's saying here. It's a very, very powerful statement. Buddhism really relies on the fact that we still have forest monastics who practice the Buddhist teachings properly and fundamentally in the right way. It relies on that. That is, I think it's very important for everybody to be aware of that, because what it means is that we try our very best to encourage monastics to move towards the forest tradition, to live in the right way, because that is where you get the real results for meditation practice. We should encourage that as monastics, encourage our fellow monastics, and as lay people also, we should try to encourage monastics in that way, through the way we speak to them, through the way we support them, and all of these kind of things. right? Then we can kind of get the prosperity in Buddhism. And you can see why it is very closely related to the previous one, because in the forest there is very few of these kind of desires that lead to rebirth. Little sensual pleasures, few hierarchies, right? Okay, you are maybe more powerful than the kangaroo, but that's about it, right? Not much of a hierarchy to talk about. So all of these things tend to fade away in the forest. You're withdrawn from those things, and you are in a peaceful and nice place at the same time. So the forest is very suitable for that. It's very connected to that. To give you some idea how important this is, there's another sutta which often is quoted by, which I quote quite regularly, and Brahm quotes it too. This is found in the Anguttara Nikaya. And this is a sutta where the Buddha is kind of walking around and he's looking at a few different monks. And he sees one monk, right? There's one monk sitting like this, very kind of good samadhi, right? Very straight, sitting there for long periods of time. But he's sitting quite close to the village, right? And so maybe just on the border of the village, if you like. Then there's this other monk sitting way into the forest, right? Far away from everybody, but he's like this. Nodding away, oh, so tired. And the fascinating thing about this, because you would think when the Buddha has seen those two monks, right, which one is he going to praise? Which one is he going to? Yeah, you know already, right? You know the answer. Okay, very, very good. So, but it's interesting because actually it's very counterintuitive. It's very different from how people normally think. Because the way that people normally think is that it doesn't matter so much what you do as long as you get the results. Right? Is that how people normally think? Oh, as long as you get the results, no worries. You can sit in your apartment at home and get samadhi, right? As long as you get the results, no problem. You go to the forest, doesn't matter where you are. Doesn't matter if you're a lay person or a monastic. Doesn't matter if you're a Muslim or a Christian or an atheist or a Buddhist, right? As long as you get the results, that's what really matters. But this is not what the Buddha is saying here. The Buddha is saying he praises the monk sitting in the forest. And he criticizes the monk sitting at the edge of the village. Because, he says, that monk who's sitting at the edge of the village, he will come out of that samadhi and then he will be disturbed by the villagers, by the people, by the novices, by, you know, whoever is around. And because he's going to be disturbed by all the things of the world, this is the sensual pleasures, the powers, the people, the chatting, whatever it is, because he's going to be disturbed, he will lose that samadhi and he will not be able to regain it in the future. I don't think he says all of those things. That's kind of implied there, right? And then he looks at the forest, the monk in the forest, and says, well, I praise that monk. Why? Because soon enough, he will overcome that tiredness. And when he overcomes the tiredness, he will no longer be disturbed by anybody. And then his samadhi and his meditation is going to go well into the future. Yeah. So it's not just about the results that we have in the moment. It's how we get those results is also important. And this is why for the long-term benefit of the Buddhist teachings, actually staying in the forest is here praised to such a high extent. To such an extent that the entire future of Buddhism, in a way, depends on it. Right? That's how important it actually is, according to this sutta. Anyway, so I must admit, I have always looked around and found the forest monastics to be the most inspiring ones. Some of the forest monastics really are very inspiring people. The way they practice, their ability to get into deep samadhi, that is where you find the vast majority of Aryans, of noble people in the world, etc., etc. I do not mean to criticize everybody else. That's not what I mean at all. Sometimes you find very good monastics who live in the city, who practice in a good way, who do lots of good work, charity work, all these kind of things. And by all means, not everybody is suited to living in the forest. So by all means, we should support them as well and praise them for what they are doing here. But the big picture is that in the end, in the long term, it is the forest monasticism that's going to support Buddhism in the future. And very important to remember that. Okay. So that is the forest lodgings. Then we have, as long as they preserve their personal mindfulness. Here you can say, as long as they remember these things, and that what they should remember is that I can't remember the exact Pali now. They should have the memory that those good spiritual companions will come to them, and those that are already with them will dwell at ease. You should keep that in mind, right? As a monastic. The idea here, of course, is that the good spiritual companions, they are the Ariyas, the noble ones especially. And of course, it's very important for the upholding of the Sangha that those people who are noble ones, the Aryans, that they actually are part of the Sangha, that we actually support them, that we listen to them, that we live our life according to how the Aryans speak. It is great, suttas, but if you have both the Aryans and the suttas together, that's the ideal combination. The problem with the suttas is that sometimes you may misinterpret them, sometimes you may misunderstand them. You can go a long way by reading the suttas yourself, and this is one of the things I want to show you by going through this, that actually it isn't so hard. But in the end, there are certain profound teachings where it is quite easy to go astray unless you have a good teacher to point out the way. Things like anatta, right, non-self. Have I really penetrated non-self all the way? Or maybe is there a little bit of corner of non-self I haven't really understood yet? These kind of issues are very, very profound and very hard to really get your head around unless you have a valuable guide. So this is why, as long as the Aryas and the Buddhist teachings, we have both of those at the same time, then we have two pillars, if you like, of Buddhism that enables Buddhism to kind of keep its insights, not lose track of what the essence of Buddhism is all about. So we should always be welcoming of these monastics, always, even if there are some lay people perhaps who are Aryas, we should always be welcoming of them, because when we welcome them, then we know that we are practicing in the right way, we're doing the right things, and we are kind of heading in the right direction as a consequence. So always be kind to them, right? And this is also true for lay, all of these things I said here is also true for lay people. Certainly the last one, as long as you keep on inviting the good monastics, right? Those people who are practicing the right way, and you look after them, then they will want to come again also in the future. And that is when both the lay community and the Sangha prospers as a consequence. So there you are. These are the seven things to be contemplated and to be practiced for the upholding of Buddhism in the future and to avoid the decline. And I don't know about you, but I find these very interesting. They're not really found anywhere else in the suttas. They're only found here in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. And it's obvious that the Buddha is teaching these things so that when he passes away, the Dhamma can carry on without his presence also long, long time into the future. So keep these things in mind. Remember these things. Some of these things are more perhaps relevant for lay people than others. But things like, you know, having the good spiritual companions being there is important. Things like having regular and harmonious assemblies, listening to the elders, right, and respecting them. These are some of the important aspects that is true for everyone, whether lay or monastic. Okay, that took a little bit longer than I had anticipated. Anyway, that's good. It's always nice to do things slowly. It's good to start off easy as well, not too kind of heavy. So I hope it's not too heavy for you. But let's have a break, about 15 minutes or so, a chance to go to the toilet and chance to have a cup of tea or whatever, and we'll see you back again at 10:45. Okay, everyone, so let us continue. So, next passage, I'll again read it out and then I'll comment on it just afterwards. And then the Lord, while staying at Vulture's Peak, gave a comprehensive discourse. This is morality, this is samadhi, this is wisdom. Samadhi, when imbued with morality, brings great fruit and profit. Wisdom, when imbued with samadhi, brings great fruit and profit. the mind imbued with wisdom becomes completely free from the corruptions, that is the corruption of sensuality, of becoming, of false views, and of ignorance. So, again, remember that what we are doing here, what we're doing is we're seeing the Buddha. He is talking about those things that are the core aspects of his teachings, right? So this is one of those passages, and this particular passage recurs in this particular sutta. It occurs many, many, many times in this sutta. Every time the Buddha stops somewhere, he stops in a little village, and he stays there every time he gives this particular teaching, right? And you may think, oh, boring, same teaching every time. How can I give the same teaching? But the point is that this is not really a teaching. This is a summary of the Buddha's teachings, right? So the teaching probably would have been slightly different in every village. But this is a way of summarizing the overall outlook of how the Buddha taught the path. And the Buddha's path is always the same. It's always morality, right? Sila, samadhi, stillness. I'm not allowed to say concentration. Ajahn Brahm says, cannot say concentration, so I say stillness. And then panya, wisdom at the end. It's always the same, right? So when you lay out the path, it's always the same. So everywhere, he would have given roughly that particular teaching, because that is how the path pretty much always works. But it's a beautiful summary of the path. And this is what it's really meant to be, a summary of what it's all about. And it shows us one of the very important structures, frameworks, for how the Buddhist path actually works. And of course, the important point with this, when we talk about these three aspects of the path, the important point here is that stillness, when imbued with sila, samadhi imbued with sila, that is the samadhi that brings great fruit and profit. Sometimes these days people are taught mindfulness meditation, all kinds of things, and they're not taught the path with all its aspects. It means the path is missing the sila aspect, the morality aspect, and if it's missing that, the meditation is never going to bring great fruit and great benefit, as it says here. The sila is a fundamental part of this particular practice. But it's more than that. You know, sometimes people think, oh yeah, I'm keeping the five precepts, you know, I'm doing really well. And I would say, good on you. This is an Australian expression. Good on you means well done, right? This is what they say in Australia, becoming Australianized. I originally not born in Australia, but these days becoming more and more Australian. So good on you. So well done. So great if people are keeping the five precepts. It's a wonderful thing to do, and you should feel really happy about that if you're able to keep those things. Because the vast majority of people around the world do not practice morality to that extent. But the point is that if we really want to succeed in meditation practice, often we have to do more than just keep the five precepts. Five precepts often may not be enough. And this is what this is saying here. It says that when stillness is imbued with sila, right? Imbued means penetrated with, fulfilled with, you know, what's the word? Pervaded with. In other words, it kind of fills it up, right, to the maximum. So this is what is important here. So the idea here is that sila has to be as strong as possible so as to pervade the samadhi to the maximum, to its maximum potential. And to be able to do that, we have to remember that sila is one of these things in Buddhism that is very profound, right? It seems kind of obvious. Most people, as I said, understand it to mean the five precepts, but actually it means much, much more than that. Sila is about our character, it's about our habits, it's about who we are as human beings, it's about the quality of your heart, if you like. What is the quality of your heart? Is it a heart that is full of kindness, wants to be beneficial for other beings, that is full of generosity, that is soft and gentle towards other beings? Is that the kind of heart one has? Is that one's personality? If it is, that is when sila starts to become very profound. Sometimes people can have all kinds of defilements. They can keep the five precepts very well and still have all kinds of defilements. And those other defilements, they are going to stop you from maximizing your samadhi, maximizing your ability to meditate. So there's a very profound statement right there. It shows us we need to take sila to the its maximum potential to be able to really meditate properly. And what this means also is that very often when people go on meditation retreats, they say, oh, my meditation isn't going so well. What could be the reason? Could it be that I'm not meditating enough hours, right? Is it one people, oh, I need to meditate more, right? Not meditating enough. There's a kind of standard reason people think meditation isn't going so well. Maybe I'm using the wrong meditation object, right? What is the best meditation object for me? Maybe it's metta, maybe it's breath meditation, maybe I should do a asubha practice. Maybe that's the right one for me. Again, it's missing the point slightly here. Or maybe I don't understand how to observe the meditation object. Maybe I'm doing something wrong with my mind, not really perceiving, not watching the object in the right way here. And all of these things can have a little bit of impact on the meditation. But the Buddha never talks about these things. What the Buddha talks about when he talks about what gives rise to meditation is always sila. It's always your habits, your character, the quality of your heart. This is what really matters. So if your meditation isn't going well, then forget about all those other questions. They are kind of irrelevant, right? Because the real question is actually, how can I up the game a little bit? How can I be a little bit better as a person? How can I purify my mind a little bit more? How can I have more time, more understanding for the people around me, have less anger and irritation? That is the real question. And that is the question we should really be working on if we want our meditation practice to improve. So, right, so very interesting right there. And of course, this is only one of many, many places in the suttas where you find this exact structure in the path. If you look at, for example, Satipatthana, the way Satipatthana is described in the suttas, it is always described as based on sila, based on ujjukaditti, based on straight view. These are the two things the Satipatthana practice is always based on. And of course, Satipatthana is all about meditation practice. It's the watching of the breath and this kind of thing, which Satipatthana is all about. And you find this throughout. You have the Noble Eightfold Path again. Always starts off with sila, right? And then you go to, eventually come to right mindfulness, which is Satipatthana again. All supported by sila and right effort. Right effort is just a way of purifying the mind. So it comes under sila in a certain way here. So very interesting and powerful teaching right there. And it is a comprehensive version of the Noble Eightfold Path. Noble Eightfold Path, again, can be said to be a comprehensive version of the gradual training, which we will look at later on. It is also a comprehensive version of the 37 Aids to Awakening, 37 Bodhipakya Dhammas, which we will also come across later on. So this is really all of the important teachings in the suttas about the practice, they are summarized by these three things. So that is samadhi, stillness being imbued with morality. And of course, the next thing then is that when wisdom is imbued with stillness, that wisdom has great benefit and great fruit. Right? Another very, very important thing, the idea that the foundation for real wisdom, if you want to have profound wisdom, is always samadhi, according to the suttas. When you read the standard description of how awakening happens according to from a first person perspective, it is always samadhi is the upanisa, the cause for yathabhuta jnanadasana, seeing things according to reality. Samadhi leads to seeing things according to reality. The standard thing that you see again and again in the suttas, and here is exactly the same thing again. Wisdom, when imbued with samadhi, the more samadhi you have, the more powerful that wisdom is, right? So samadhi is the cause here. A very important thing, because I think this is still in the present day often misunderstood in meditation circles. The importance of that stillness of the mind actually comes through in these kind of teachings. And then, of course, once you have that wisdom imbued with stillness, then the mind is liberated. And it is liberated from the corruption. The corruptions here are the asavas, right? Asava in Pali are kind of the root defilements in the mind. And they are usually of three kinds. The sensuality of existence. He says becoming here, but existence is a much better translation, I think. and ignorance. The views is actually an addition in this particular sutta, which is not found anywhere else. So it seems to be a late addition to this particular sutta. So the basic three asavas are sensuality, existence, and ignorance here, avidya, which I prefer to translate as delusion, misunderstanding of the nature of reality, really. So these are then destroyed, right? What are these asavas? They are the root defilements of the mind. And if you, as I mentioned before, if you remember the second noble truth, it talks about three types of craving. And this is very closely related to those three types of craving, because we have the craving for sensuality, craving for existence, and craving for annihilation. Right? So these are very closely related to that. So the asava is the thing which drives the round, in the same way that craving drives the round of existence. Birth and death, birth and death, birth and death. These things are very, very closely related to each other. And this gives you an idea what is meant by these kind of corruptions. That desire for those things is what really it means. Desire for sensuality, craving for existence. And the last one, the ignorance, is very closely related to the desire for annihilation, because as long as we haven't seen reality as it actually is, as long as we haven't seen the idea of non-self, then sometimes we want to annihilate ourselves, right? Oh, life is so miserable, I just want to commit suicide, I had enough of all this. The whole world hates me, I hate myself, okay, time to kind of make an end of all this misery in life. And sometimes people do commit suicide when they feel really, really miserable in life. It is based, this desire for kind of committing suicide and for ending existence is based on a misunderstanding. It is based on that ignorance that there is something to be destroyed inside of us when in fact there isn't. All of us have a feeling of atta. Unless you are an Arya, you have a feeling of a sense of self, right? You feel that you are a certain person. You feel you have certain character traits inside of you. You feel, I exist. You may not be able to pin it down exactly, but you feel that there's some way that you exist inside of you. This is the misperception of an atta, according to the suttas. And as long as you have that misperception of an atta, which is ignorance, then sometimes the idea of annihilation can arise. You want to destroy yourself because you feel so much suffering and pain in life. So a close relationship between vibhavatana, desire for extermination, and ignorance as well. Just to kind of show you how these things are related to each other, the tanha and the asavas, the craving and the corruptions are related to each other in this case. So there you are, very nice and I think an important teaching. Everything is so nice and important, right? Sometimes you don't know what to do. So, okay. Let's move on to the next one. So now there is you can see the little dots there. These are only extracts. It's not a continuous narrative. So I've jumped over large sections in the Pali and just taken out a few things that I thought was most interesting for this retreat. That's why it is the way it is. So the little dots means I have taken out large chunks. So if you want to read the stuff in between, then you're going to have to go home and bring it up. And if you haven't got these books, if you haven't got the long discourses at home, you can always go online, go to Sutta Central. Sutta Central has all the discourses online, and you can read it there for yourself. SuttaCentral.net is a great resource for reading the suttas. Okay, let's go on to the next one. So here, the Buddha has now moved on to Pataliputta, or Pataligama, which is what I talked about before. And this is on the banks of the river Ganges, so he's walking north, right, towards basically his destination, which is Kusinara. And now he's talking to these householders at Pataligama, the future Pataliputta, the future capital of this vast empire of Magadha. And householders, there are these five advantages to one of good morality and of success in morality. What are they? In the first place, through careful attention to his affairs, he gains much wealth. In the second place, he gets a good reputation. In the third place, whatever assembly he approaches, whether of Kshatriyas, Brahmins, householders, or ascetics, he does so with confidence and assurance. In the fourth place, he dies unconfused. In the fifth place, after death, at the breakup of the body, he arises in a good destination in a heavenly world. These are the five advantages to one of good morality, of sila, and of success in morality, sila sampada. So this is given to householders. Often the Buddha would give this kind of teaching to the householders at that time. And remember that when you read this, it may seem like a very simple teaching until you understand what I was saying before about morality, sila, being very profound. It has all these factors, right, that have to do with personality and character, not just to do with our outward conduct, but also our inner conduct inside of ourselves is part of this. So once you understand that sila is so broad, then you understand this actually is much more profound than it looks at the very first time when you see this. And in fact, I would say that the vast majority of the Buddhist path is really about getting your sila right. Once your sila is right, everything else tends to fall into place. Once the sila is right, meditation works. Once the sila is right and meditation works, the panya, the wisdom, comes as well. So that is really the hard part, getting the sila into place. So, still, the five successes here, the five advantages are fairly worldly advantages, but still worthwhile to think about, I think. And the first one here is, it says here, through careful attention. But really, the Pali word is appamada. And I don't think careful attention is perhaps the best translation. The translation I like is heedfulness, through heedfulness. Heedfulness means, it is similar in a way to careful attention. It means to be careful, to be circumspect, to think about things properly before you act, and that kind of stuff, right? So appamada is really the word here. If you have appamada, then it says here you gain much wealth. And you don't lose your wealth. If you have the opposite, if you have pamada, you tend to lose your wealth, right? It's the exact opposite. And this is interesting, I think, because usually appamada and pamada, usually they have to do with morality. So if you are heedful, it means you are a moral person, you live well. But here it is also connected to wealth, right? So if you are a moral person, if you are careful with how you live your life in a moral sense, right, if you are one of these people who think about things properly, if you are a reflective kind of person rather than somebody who just acts on whim or whatever, then it has the benefit, one, that you're going to be moral, but also that it tends to look after your affairs in the world and to look after your money, after your wealth. So it's interesting, this connection between morality and worldly success. These things are not disjoint, they actually often go together. Because if you live an upright life, if you are careful, that carefulness tends to have an effect in all aspects of life, both in your spiritual life, but also in the worldly aspects of your life. So these root things, appamada is one of the root things of the Dhamma. If you go to the Anguttara Nikaya, for example, the Anguttara ones, you find there are certain things that are at the very base of the spiritual practice, that form the foundation upon which everything else is built. And one of those things is appamada. Right, but there's one thing in the world that is kind of that is the root thing for everything else. It is appamada. Is one of them. Another one is yonisomanasikara, careful reflection. Another one is right view, right? Another one is noble friendship, the kalyanamitta. All of these things are at the very base, at the root, because without those things, you don't go anywhere here. Basically, you are stuck. So there you are. So that's an interesting one in its own right. Another one is that you get a good reputation, right? If you are a moral and good person, you get a good reputation in the world, especially among those people who are. It is worth having a good reputation among, right? So all the good people in the world would say, "Yay, well done! You're living a good life." And they may not say that, but maybe they will think that sometimes, So people will generally will praise you for that. And if you are immoral, the good people will tend to be a bit skeptical of you. They may not kind of criticize you to your face, but they might think, oh, I'm not sure about this person, I don't really trust them. So many of the scallywags, the dodgy characters in the world, will not praise you for being moral, but who cares what those scallywags think anyway. So third place, whatever assembly you approach, if you are moral, you feel confident and assured, whether it is Kshatriyas, Brahmins, householders, or ascetics. So these are the different types of people that you would have met in India at that time, right? These are the Kshatriyas, the powerful people, the warriors, the administrators, the Brahmins, the priestly caste, the ascetics, the people who have gone forth. And sometimes if you were an ordinary person, you might feel a bit nervous, right, when you come to these very powerful people and you kind of have to, you know, go to that assembly, you might feel nervous. But if you are moral, the more pure your morality is, the more confident you are in approaching any kind of assembly. It's interesting, isn't it? Why is that? How come you feel confident just because you are moral? And I think the answer is that when you are moral, when you live your life well, you know that nobody can really blame you for anything, right? If you are an immoral person, you might feel that other people are judging you or looking at you. And if you walk into an assembly where there are many wise and powerful people, you may feel, oh, they're going to judge me, right? Because they didn't know that I'm a bad person or something like that. You may not think that. You may think, oh, I'm really good, but they think I'm bad because you are deluding yourself probably. But you, this is usually how people work. But if you are moral, if you live well, you know that there's nothing in you that can be blamed, right? Nobody has a right to judge you. So even when you kind of stand up in front of an assembly or come to an assembly, it's not gonna. You, even if other people do blame you, you know it's false. You know it's not right because you do live an upright life. You have nothing to fear really in that kind of situation, and that's why you tend to feel confident and assured, even going to these kind of assemblies. I have seen that in my own life. The people who often are the most kind of assured in certain ways are the people who are precisely very good people, unless you have a kind of a very big ego or something. That's another way of doing it, but that's not really recommended, because if you have a big ego, you're also very vulnerable, because if people criticize you, you will kind of, you know, you will take that very seriously and all these kind of things. But the people have a natural quiet kind of confidence, not kind of bragging or anything like that, but a quiet confidence, are the people I have noticed in the world who are very, also are very tend to be confident in a quiet kind of way, not in a bragging way, but in a quiet kind of low key way. And I think you will see the same if you look around carefully. And in the fourth place, you die unconfused. Right? If you are immoral, you have no mindfulness, which saw just before that samadhi and morality goes together. And if you are immoral, you tend to be confused. Mindfulness is not there. And of course, the moment you die, it is very useful to be reasonably mindful, because if you have mindfulness when you die, it means you have a little bit of ability of directing your mind. You don't direct your mind. You don't become angry so easy. You don't fall prey to desires. Mindfulness is that which enables you to keep a pure mind. You stop the anger from arising. You stop the desire from arising. But if you die with a confused mind, then all kind of negative states can arise, right, as you're dying. And that can have a very bad effect on your rebirth, because you have no sense of direction anymore in the way you do this. So it's perhaps not very clear what I'm saying there, because it could probably be misunderstood in many different ways, but we can talk more about that later on if you're interested, about the dying process and these kind of things. And of course, the last one, which is also really bad news, is that you end up in a bad destination, right? So if you love yourself, please make sure that you act well in this life. Otherwise, you're penalizing yourself. There's a very nice passage Where did I talk about that recently? I can't remember now. I talked about this recently as well. It's a nice passage in the, I think actually I talked about that Dhammaloka Center actually, passage in the Kosala Sanyuta, where the Buddha is having a conversation with King Pasenadi of Kosala, and they're talking together, and the king goes to the Buddha, and he says to the Buddha that those people who do bad things in the world, they are acting towards themselves as if they are their own enemy. Why? Because if you are bad, it means that you're creating suffering for yourself. The only people in the world you want to create suffering for is your enemies. So you're acting as if you're your own enemy if you do bad things, right? It's very interesting. Normally we think of things that if I do something bad towards somebody else, I'm acting as their enemy. I'm being the enemy of that person. But you're actually being much more your own enemy because you have to reap the results of your badness far more than the person you're acting towards. Because that karma will have an effect for a long, long time into the future. You will blame yourself. You will feel bad things about yourself. So it's interesting how you end up actually being your own enemy, in a sense, every time you do something which isn't quite nice. And if you do something which is nice and kind to other people, you're acting as if you are your own friend. Right? Because you're doing things that will lead to your own happiness and your own benefit in the future. So be your own friend, for goodness sake. Don't be your own enemy. Yeah. Makes sense, right? So otherwise you end up in this way and you end up being reborn in an unpleasant destination next time around. And that is not very good, not very useful at all. Okay. So these are the five advantages of good morality, of success in morality, that we find in this Mahaparinibbana Sutta. And now we can go on to some other things that are probably a bit more interesting, because these are the things that are really core aspects, again, of the sort of things the Buddha was talking about as he was about to pass away. So now, again, we are kind of fast-forwarding here a little bit. We're going all the way to the time when the Buddha has arrived at Vesali, and he was staying at Vesali for the rains retreat. It was the last rains retreat of the Buddha, and this is what happened during that rains retreat. And during the rains, the Lord was attacked by a severe illness with sharp pains as if he were about to die. But he endured all of this mindfully, clearly aware, and without complaining. He thought, "It is not fitting that I should attain final nibbana without addressing my followers and taking leave of the order of monks. I must hold the disease in check by energy and apply myself to the force of life." And he did so, and the disease abated. So, here we have the Buddha, we can see here now coming after the rains. He's getting towards the very end of his life, right? Attacked by severe illnesses with sharp pains and all of these kind of things. And it reminds you that the Buddha is human just like all the rest of us. Right? He has the same kind of physical problems. When you get old, even if you are an arahant, even if you are a Buddha, you still have to go through the problems of old age with the body falling apart and all of that. And these are the kind of passages in the sutta that reminds us of the humanity of the Buddha. The Buddha, in a sense, is one of us, right? And this is one of the things I like to always to point out to people. It is very important to remember that the Buddha is one of us. He is a human being. He was born into this world. You find in many places in the suttas, he talks about his own life. And he will talk about his own defilements, right? He will say, "Well, I had these problems. I had problems with anger and desire as well when I was still a layperson in lay life, before I became a Buddha. I had wrong view," he says in other places. Here we see that he has a physical body, just like the rest of us, with the same problems that it leads to having a physical body. It's very important to remember that, because the Buddha, if he is one of us, then his life has incredible significance for us. Then the way he lived, the way he became awakened, when he teaches about his own life, it relates directly to our own lives. When he says, this is how I practiced, then he is saying, well, this is how you should be practicing as well. This is the example I have been setting for you. So many of the Buddha suttas are autobiographical suttas where he talks about his own practice. And of course, it is to inspire us to say, this is what I did. You should be doing the same. So if you put the Buddha on the wrong kind of pedestal, and you think that the Buddha, he was this amazing person who practiced for four incalculable eons or whatever, or he is the cosmic principle of the universe and all these kind of things, or he is some kind of god, right? I mean, this is the sort of stuff you will often hear in popular Buddhist culture. Then he is out of reach. And the Buddha's biography is irrelevant to us. We can't follow what some god did. We can't follow what the cosmic principle did, because we're not the cosmic principle. Anyone here who is the cosmic principle? If you are, then you can maybe follow that, right? Otherwise you can't, because you're different. So this is the problem. But once we recognize that the Buddha is a human being, he is in many ways special because he has taken the human condition to its highest potential, right? Which of course is very remarkable. He is an arahant, fully awakened, all this kind of thing. But he started out as a human being, just like us. And once we get that, once we understand that, the suttas where he talks about his own practice become very meaningful and very powerful examples of how we should practice as well. Otherwise, you might really think, yeah, well, this is what the Buddha practiced. Okay, no need for me to look at that because that's beyond me, right? That's how you tend to think. But actually, no, that is the wrong way of thinking about these things. So this doesn't mean that we shouldn't put the Buddha on a pedestal. Of course, it is important to respect the Buddha, but we should respect the Buddha in the right way, not in the wrong way. It's how we respect the Buddha that is really important. And the way we respect the Buddha is to understand that, first of all, he took the human potential to its took the human condition to its highest potential. That already is pretty amazing, right? But what is even more amazing about the Buddha, he did so without a teacher. He was able to find this way on his own, find this Noble Eightfold Path. He didn't really find the path. It's more like kind of a trial and error. He made a lot of errors on the way. That's why he did all the ascetic practices and all of that, right? Because he didn't really know what he was doing. He was trying to find his way. He was blind, just like the rest of us. But he was able to discover the truth. And this is what is so astonishing about the Buddha. The fact that he was the first person to do this, and he was able to find awakening. And that is why we bow down to the Buddha and say, well, this is somebody who has these remarkable qualities. So we have to think about the Buddha in the right way. When you think about the Buddha in the right way, it becomes very powerful. If you think about him in the wrong way, it can actually detract from our practice. So please keep that in mind. And this is one of the little things that comes out from this little passage here, right? The sicknesses and the sharp pains and all of that. When you read the commentaries as well to the sutta, sometimes they have kind of lost touch with that reality already in the Theravadan commentaries. And they talk about the Buddha walking along and his skin is so smooth that no dust can ever adhere to his skin, right? That kind of stuff. And to me, then he is no longer human, right? What kind of person is it? What kind of human being is it that has no dust that can adhere to your skin? This is impossible. When you walk around, your feet get dusty. As in the commentary, because in the sutta it says, oh, the Buddha would sit down and he would wash his feet, right? And the commentary says, oh, that was just for show, to give a good example for the other monks, right? You have to wash your feet, first of all. And I don't buy that kind of stuff. I think that's ridiculous in my opinion. Of course, if the Buddha doesn't, as he says, what he does, the way he acts is always with integrity, I don't think, it makes no sense to me that he would do this kind for show. It would be the real thing. Anyway, that is just to bring us back to reality a little bit. So, but of course, even though he had these pains, he endured all of that, right? With mindfulness and clear awareness. But he had to endure it. Even for the Buddha, having pain in the body is not a pleasant thing here. For nobody is it pleasant. And then, of course, he thinks then that it is not fitting that I should attain final nibbana without addressing my followers, the upataka, the attendants. and take leave of the order of monks. So he wants to say goodbye, it seems, before he passes away here. And then he says, I must hold this disease in check by energy and apply myself to the force of life. And when he did that, the disease abated here. So the idea here is that when we die depends on our mind state and our intention. And very often when you come to the end of your life, you have some say in whether you're going to die or not. There are some very interesting studies on people, when people die, and very often people die just after they had their birthday party, right? Or just after Christmas, or just after maybe Chinese New Year or something like that. Because then you have done something that you were looking forward to, you're going to be with your family, and then afterwards okay, now it's time to die and to go. And it shows us that we have some control over our own death. There's some degree of control there. And that is exactly what the Buddha is doing here. He's applying himself to the life force that things would make to carry on a little bit longer. Okay. So, then the Lord, having recovered from his sickness, as soon as he felt better, went outside and sat down on a prepared seat in front of his dwelling. Then the Venerable Ananda came to him, bowed down to him, sat down to one side and said, Lord, I have seen the Lord in discomfort. Should be discomfort there. There's something wrong here. I have seen the Lord patient enduring. And, Lord, my body was like a drunkard's. I lost my bearings, and things were unclear to me because of the Lord's sickness. The only thing that was some comfort to me was the thought, the Lord will not attain final nibbana until he has made some statement about the order of monks. So here, Venerable Ananda, who is already a stream enterer, even he finds it very hard to deal with the fact that the Buddha is about to pass away, right? So all of these things is as if he's losing his mindfulness here. He's losing his bearings. Everything become unclear because obviously he finds it hard to deal with this. So there's obviously some sadness there, some attachment to the Buddha, even though he's a stream enterer. So it shows us how powerful these attachments can be, even when you've gone as far on this path as Venerable Ananda has done. Of course, the Buddha passing away obviously is a very powerful occasion for all of Buddhism, so we have a very, very strong effect on everybody. But still, it is fascinating how powerful it actually is. And then he says the only thing that comforts him is that the Buddha will not pass away until he has made some statement about the order of monks. And this seems to refer to some kind of statement about who is now going to be the leader, who is going to take over, what's going to happen when the Buddha passes away here. What's going to happen to Buddhism next? But of course the Buddha replies as follows, but Ananda, what does the order of monks expect of me? I have taught the Dhamma, Ananda, making no inner and outer. The Tathagata has no teacher's fist in respect of doctrines. If there is anyone who thinks I shall take charge of the order, or the order should refer to me, let him make some statement about the order. But the Tathagata does not think in such terms. So why should the Tathagata make a statement about the order? Right? This is one of those very important statements that you find in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta about the Buddha's teaching and about how we should relate this particular teaching here. He starts off by saying, I have made no outer and inner, right? Anantara Abbahira. The idea is that there is no inner circle of disciples that get special teachings, and then all the the outer disciples that are not so important, right? And they don't get those special teachings. There is no such thing in Buddhism. In Buddhism, everything is laid out plain for everybody to see. And it's obvious why that is the case when you understand what the purpose of the Dhamma is. The purpose of the Dhamma is to create happiness in the world. It's to enable people to improve their lives, to move away from suffering, and to move towards happiness. Because the purpose is always compassion for all beings, to help everybody to live in the right way, in a good way, that is a benefit to themselves. Of course, you have to lay it out in the open. These are these teachings. I have compassion for you. Of course I'm going to make these things available to everyone. Right? Instead of having a small circle of relative, of disciples, I will give you the inner teaching and you will be special, right? You will be my real disciples. And everyone else, they will be kind of outer. And you see this when you look at some of the dodgy kind of sects in the world. That is exactly how these dodgy sects tend to work. Right? If you are close to the guru, he will give you special teachings. And there will be all the other people who get lesser teachings. And all the other people, they will then want to become part of that inner circle. They will fight to become part of the inner circle so they too can get access to those special teachings. It's a way of controlling people to have an inner and an outer. It's a way to create sects and to create cults and that kind of thing. That's what it's really all about. And the Buddhist teaching is not like that at all. So I'm always very wary when I hear about any kind of teaching anywhere where they have an inner and outer, they have secret teachings and open teachings. I always think, this is not for me. There's something wrong about this. There's something which isn't right. The Buddha said exactly the opposite. If the Buddha said the opposite, then surely this is not the right way to live, not the right way to do things. So very important teaching right there. It tells us something about Buddhism and why it is always okay to ask questions, always okay to inquire, always okay to seek out the full meaning of these teachings. Even if you aren't at the end of the path yet, even if you haven't gone that far, still there is no inner and outer. It doesn't mean, of course, that necessarily it is always right to teach everything to everybody. Sometimes people are not ready for certain teachings, right? There are certain teachings in Buddhism that are very profound and hard to understand. So of course there is a time for everything. There may be at the beginning of the path you learn the more basic things and you learn more profound things afterwards. But if you ask, you will normally get an answer. So there is there is some degree of balance there, of course, but there is no secrets as such. Everything is actually available to everyone. So I think that is a very important point in Buddhism, something really worthwhile remembering here. And that the Tathagata has no teacher's fist, right? The idea that there are some teachings that have been withheld, that now when he is about to die, now he's going to make this statement, like Ananda says, he will not attain final Nibbana without making some statement, right? But the Buddha has no teacher's fist. He has no teachings that are held back. Nothing that now can be revealed in the very final moment of things. So because he hasn't got that, there is no statement to be made at this particular point. The Buddha is open about things, teaching things out of compassion for the world, so everyone can benefit from these remarkable and astonishing teachings. So simple and yet so profound. And then he says, also very important, the very last part of the paragraph here. If there is anyone who thinks, I shall take charge of the order, the Sangha, should refer to me, let that person make some statement about the order. Right? So what the Buddha is saying here is that I am not appointing a successor. I am not saying that somebody is going to take over from the Tathagata and now lead the order. Right? No successor. Again, a very important statement. When we think about Buddhism in the whole world, remember there is no successor. There is nobody who really takes the place of the Buddha. The Buddha is the originator of all these things. Everything really refers back to him and to those teachings. You take refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, right? So very important statement again, which often I think is missed when people think about the Buddhist path. And the Buddha then says that the Tathagata does not think in such terms. The Tathagata the Buddha does not think, I will be in charge of the order. The order should refer to me. The whole thing has been compacted here, so that's why you can't see the whole thing. That's actually what he says. The Tathagata does not think, I am in charge of the order. The order should refer to me. Right? He doesn't even think like that. And this is kind of interesting as well, isn't it? Because we think of the Buddha as the leader. We think of the Buddha as the person everybody goes to when they have a problem, when the Sangha can't decide of something, some rule of conduct or whatever it is. They go to the Buddha and ask for clarification. We tend to think of the Buddha as the leader. But the Buddha does not think of himself like that. The Buddha, what he thinks of himself as the compassionate person who has understood everything there is to understand about happiness and suffering in the world, who has a message for people who are willing to listen, and he will deliver that message, and he will do that out of compassion for the world. But he doesn't see himself as a leader. He doesn't see himself as everybody should refer back to him. He's just acting to help people in the world out of compassion, because he understands the difference between suffering and happiness. And of course, because he doesn't see himself as a leader, then why should he appoint somebody else as a leader when there is no need for a leader in the first place from the Buddha's point of view? So very interesting. So remember, once you are a leader, once you have that position, there is a problem there. Then you have a vested interest. You know, I am the leader, I am the boss or whatever. Then there is this idea of hierarchy again, the idea of perhaps, you know, gaining honor and fame and all of these kind of things. Take that hierarchy away. The Buddha has no interest in being honored, being famous, any of that. His only interest is in helping people wherever they are in the world with the Dhamma, because he understands the Dhamma has the ability to help people get out of suffering and find happiness instead. So this is one of those beautiful things about the Buddha that I always like to focus on. The Buddha has no vested interest in being a teacher. By that I mean there is nothing for him to be gained when he is a teacher. In fact, the Buddha loses something when he is a teacher. When the Buddha is a teacher, he has to move away from his meditation practice, move away from the stillness of the mind, move away from peace and all these kind of things. So he has a negative vested interest. It's actually a burden for him to teach the world, right? He would rather chill in a cave somewhere, relax. Now all this teaching business, just a problem for the Buddha. And that is why his compassion and his teachings are so pure. He doesn't get anything out of it. This is very, very pure teachings. And this is one of the reasons I personally love to read the suttas, because I know that these suttas only have one purpose. They are taught out of compassion for everyone. Every one of us here today, myself, everyone in the world, that's why they are taught. No vested interest, nothing in it for the Buddha at all, apart from compassion for the whole world. Okay, I think we better stop there. I suppose I stopped already, actually, so a little bit behind there. But anyways, that is setting us up for more excitement this afternoon. Now, let us go and have lunch, and then we'll see you again at 2:00. Yeah.